San Diego.
Carmen alcoholic. Grateful to be sober. It's a privilege for me to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege for me to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not my favorite thing to do. It's not my least favorite thing to do. I'll tell you, I'm nervous. I was sharing with somebody earlier. This is. I like to talk to a bunch of people I don't know. Rather than I came here tonight and found out there's a lot of people in this meeting that I know already, and it's good to see some old friends and meet some new friends. And the reason I like to talk to people I don't know is because it's easier to lie. I'm a liar. I'm a cheat. I'm a thief. You know, and that started when I was really young. If you're a liar and you're a cheat and you're a thief, welcome to the human race. If you're anything like me and you drink because lying and cheating and feeling makes you uncomfortable, that's your solution to that discomfort, that restlessness, that irritability that I feel when I know that I've lied to you, I've cheated you, I've stolen from you because I know I'm not supposed to. I was raised better than the way I act, and a drink will always take that away from me. So if you're here tonight and drinking makes you feel better than you act, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Stephen. You did a great job. Everything that needed to be said was said tonight. I'd like to congratulate the two birthday people, Jennifer. 4 years is a long time. And Joey, I saw Joey get sober. I lost a lot of money on that man. It's good to see you sober, being of service in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Actually, I owe a lot of people 20. Same people I owe for Larry. Larry, Damien, thank you for inviting me. I'd like to thank the group for you know who I'd really like to thank tonight? I know if this meeting is like the other meetings that I attend, there are a group of men and women who showed up early tonight. And they set these chairs up, and they made the coffee, and they put out the podium, and they made sure that the microphone worked, and they set up the literature, and they set up everything so that this meeting could happen, so that you and I could come here tonight and meet in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you to the people that I say are being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. I really appreciate it. Because if you guys hadn't showed up, the coffee would have tasted a lot different if I had to make it. That's actually good coffee here tonight. I don't usually drink AA coffee, but you guys make a good cup. Who's the coffee maker? Good job. I like that. Like I said, I'm a liar and a cheat and a thief. I drink for the effect produced by alcohol. The effect produced for this alcoholic is a sense of ease and comfort. Now, the book says a sense of ease and comfort that comes on after a few drinks. I'm going to talk some about my family tonight. I've got an older sister that's a year older than I am. I've got a younger sister that's a year younger than I am, and I have a little brother that's 3 years younger than I am. And when I think about my alcoholism and my drinking, sometimes I relate to my family. They're the people I know the most about intimately. And I hear a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think of my family because they exhibit some of the things I hear shared from the podium that are described as alcoholism. I am selfish and self-centered to the core. I am unable to create a true partnership with another human being. When you spend as much time thinking about yourself as I do, it's hard to be with another human being. I have my older sister. She's got this daughter who has a daughter. My sister's granddaughter is in high school. She invited one of her friends to come and live with her to finish out her high school year because her parents had gotten divorced. My sister asked her daughter to ask this little girl to go someplace else for Christmas because my sister did not want to spend Christmas with anybody but her family. That's what I did. I'm like, you selfish human being. She's selfish to the core. Now, she has tried alcohol a couple times. Can you imagine that? A couple times. It didn't work for her. She didn't find a sense of relief from her selfishness and self-centeredness by drinking alcohol. Now, my little sister, she's a waitress. She's been a waitress her whole life. She started waiting tables when she was 15. Like I said, she's a year younger than I am. So she's been waiting tables for about 50 years. She works on her feet. She has to deal with us. She works in this restaurant that has a bar in it. So she has to deal with people like you and I. And she comes home. I was visiting her in Fresno one year at Christmas. She came home and she's like, "Today was a bear. I need a drink." She got this bottle of vodka. It sits up on top of the refrigerator. She brings it down. She pours a drink. Takes her about a half an hour to finish it. She decides she's going to have another drink. She makes another drink. She never finished that one. She found the sense of ease and comfort. She took that edge off that she got from dealing with people like you and I all day long. That bottle of vodka, the same bottle of vodka, was up there the next year when I went up there for Christmas. I don't understand it. That's not how I drink. But then again, I don't drink the way Stephen drinks either. I don't ever remember having 50 drinks a day. I've never had cirrhosis of the liver. I've never been in a hospital because of my physical condition from drinking. Now, my little brother, about 10 years ago, actually before I got sober, so it was about 15 years ago, he got busted for a DUI. My little brother likes to drink. He drinks similarly to the way I drink. He has more than one. He has more than two. He actually likes to get a buzz on. And he's foolish enough to drive when he drinks. He actually likes a can of beer in between his legs while he's driving his truck home from work in Utah. He got a DUI. They told him if he ever had another DUI, it was going to cost him a lot of money. He likes his money. My little brother manages to control his drinking. He'll come home from work now. He doesn't have a drink till he gets home from work. He'll pour a drink, roll a joint, go downstairs, sit in his ZZ chair in front of his TV, drink that drink, smoke that joint, and he's okay for the evening. And he can do that every day. One or two drinks. Just enough to take the edge off. Because he got a DUI. I don't get it. I have a tendency to drink until I'm out of money. They kick me out of the bar. The bar's shut down. We're out of booze at the party. And somebody messed up big time. I drink till I'm out. And then I have to go home. And here's what happens at my house. I'm never out of booze at my house. I've never been homeless. I don't want to figure out where my next drinks are going to come from. I go to work every day because I want to figure out where my... I like that part of Dr. Bob's story where he talks about going to work every day so he can earn that paycheck, so that he can buy that booze, so he can go to work, so he can earn the paycheck, so he can buy the booze. And I think I might be misquoting, but I think that went on for 17 years. I don't understand getting sober young. My sobriety date is September 9th of 2001. On September 21st, 2001, I turned 52. So you guys that have come in your 20s or your 30s or your 40s are quitters. You got to drink past the problems. Just keep drinking. They'll go away sooner or later. Or, see, I got sober because I was afraid I was going to lose everything. I'm a looking good kind of guy. Homelessness does not look good to me. You know, I like having stuff. I've always been willing to put something in me, on me, or around me to change the way I feel. Booze, clothes, furniture, art, anything. See, because I spend my life watching you. And I assume that you're doing the same thing. You're watching me. It took me till I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that you're as selfish and self-centered as I am, and you're not paying any attention to me at all. But see, what I do is I'm out there in the world, and I'm in life. Now, and I'm in kindergarten, and I'm watching those kids play with each other. And you know, and the teacher says, okay, it's time to lay down and take a nap. And they lay down and they take a nap. And I lay down and I'm like, I don't want to take a nap. Come on. And I'm nudging the kid next to me and I'm talking to the girl on this side of me. And before you know it, I'm out in the hallway by myself. Because I'm that kid that's going to, if I'm up and awake, you're going to be up and awake. That was to start a theme for me in school. I don't like school. I don't like structure. I don't like people telling me what to do. I never matured beyond kindergarten. Emotionally. I still don't like people telling me what to do. My sponsor tells me that's because I'm immature. It has nothing to do with alcoholism. It just, I'm immature. So there I am, and I'm in kindergarten. You know, if I was in school today, they would have medicated me. Definitely would have medicated me. I might not have needed alcohol till I was 15. I think I had my first drink when I was 13. I think. I have a vague memory. Back in the 50s, you could actually, your kids, me, I was 12 years old. Actually, I was 12. And Jimmy Clark, I took over his paper route. And he invited his family, said, why don't you bring Darwin up to the cabin, and we're going to go spend the night at the cabin, and we're going to get up in the morning, we're going to walk the creek, we're going to gig some fish. You know, you get that little three-pronged thing on the bottom, and you go walk through the river, and you gig trout, and that's what you have for dinner that night. And we're hiking, and we get home that night, and Jimmy Clark made a couple of drinks. Now, I remember him making the drinks. The next thing I remember is Jimmy Clark locking himself in the bathroom. I remember I reacted like weird to the drink, because I was raised a Mormon in northern Utah. My community is 98% LDS Mormon. There's alcohol's not readily available. I didn't see alcohol. I think that's the first time I ever saw alcohol. First time I'd been around alcohol. I don't know if I drank it or not. I do remember later on being at winter camp when Danny Wetstein had a quart of beer and he had three guys sitting with him. I do remember standing there watching him share that beer with those other three guys and wishing I could be a part of that crew. Now, I don't know if that was the phenomena of craving. I don't know if that was just wanting to be a part of. I do remember I didn't get any of that beer. So in the 10th grade, when I was 10 in the 4th grade, they gave me an award for checking the most books out of the elementary school library. 365 books. So I had checked out of the elementary school library during the school year. So what happens is I found this book, and it was about white kids being stolen by the Indians. And I was convinced if I'd only lived 150 years earlier, if some Indians would just come along and lift me up and take me out of my home, and I could be an Indian instead of this blonde-haired, blue-eyed Scandinavian, my life would be different. My life would be worth living. I was discontented. I was restless. I was irritable at the age of 10. I could have used that drink that Jimmy Clark offered me. What I found was a book. I got to disappear into these books. I actually, when I was young and in therapy, and the therapist, when he found out that I was like obsessed with reading, he said, do you relate to one of the characters in the books that you read? And I'm like, no. I like to all the characters. I don't play just one part in the books I read. I play all the parts. Because I'm not satisfied with who I am. I'm not satisfied with one aspect. I want to be everything and anything. Anything to change the way I feel. I didn't really get to start drinking. I mean, going to the what do they call those? Movie theaters outside in the car. There's people in here my age. Going to the drive-in with three of my buddies. There's four of us. Somebody gets two six-packs of beer. I remember I drank more than anybody else. That was it. Two six-packs of beer between four of us. You know, nowadays that's like, I got another story about that, but that's later. I remember I lived in northern Utah, so you could drive to Idaho because Idaho, we could go to Idaho and buy liquor. In my hometown, they had a state-run liquor store. I don't remember even seeing beer in the grocery stores until in the mid-60s when Albertsons moved into my hometown. And then you would see beer in the beer coolers. Up until then, I don't remember seeing alcohol readily available. I didn't look for it. I didn't know it was the solution that I was going to find later on. So we did all that experimenting with drinking, but you know what happened for me is I ended up in the Navy. Actually, first of all, I went on a Mormon mission. I was 19 years old. Before I went on my mission, I'd spent the summer in California working in a carnival. I decided that Utah was just way too small, that I needed to come to California and find out who I was. So I went to my mom. I said, you know, I'm going to move in with my older sister. She was living in L.A. She said, well, you better get your laundry done. And if you go down to the one-hour Martinizing, they'll sell you a laundry bag for a buck and a half so that you have some place to put your dirty laundry. And I had found a ride through the ride board at the university, and I packed all my stuff up, and I got in the car with this with a couple other people that were driving to Los Angeles, and my mom gave me $20, and I came to L.A. And I got this job in a carnival, and I worked in a different city in California all summer. And that's where I had my first drunk. There was some guys in the carnival. There's two groups of people in the carnival. There's the people who run the booths and the people who run the games, or the rides. And the guys that run the rides are rowdies, because they're rowdy. And two of these guys, one had a pint of bourbon, and one had a pint of rum. And they asked me if I wanted some. Well, I was 18 years old. I wanted to feel a part of. I wanted to belong with these guys. They were older than I was. They were rough and they were tough. They were everything that I thought I wanted to be. And so we started passing around this rum, and we started passing around this bourbon, and I'm swinging out of the bottle, and I'm having a good time until all of a sudden I start getting dizzy, and it's time for me to go to bed. And I live in this trailer where we keep all the stuffed animals from our games, and I go in there and I lay down, and I'm getting really dizzy, and I realize that I'm not going to be able to go to sleep till I puke, and I get up and I puke, and I go back to, and I pass out. And that was my first opportunity drinking the way I like to drink. And what it did for me, I don't remember this whole like, oh, I finally come home, I found everything I've been looking for. All I remember is puking, drinking, puking, passing out, getting up. And then when I was invited to do it again, I said, okay, I just make sure that I don't mix rum and brandy together. Or whatever. Two different, just don't mix it together. The next time I got drunk, it was gin. Don't ever drink gin again. I didn't drink gin for 30 years. The point being, and I love that part in the big book where it says in the We Agnostics, if when you start drinking, you find out you can't control how much you're going to drink or what's going to happen, or when you try to stop entirely, you find you cannot, you may be alcoholic. It doesn't say if you drink 50 drinks a day. It doesn't say if you go to prison. It doesn't say if you lose your job or your family or your car or your house. It doesn't say if those things occur in your life, you may be an alcoholic. It says, if when you start drinking, you find out you don't know what's going to happen, or when you try to stop entirely, you find out you can't, you may be an alcoholic. I read that. I'm like, ooh. Sometimes I can go to the bar at 10 o'clock in the morning, have a couple of cocktails, go home, not want to leave. I don't want to leave. I want to stay there and drink, but the people I'm with want to leave, and I'm riding with them, so we got to leave. Because it's a Sunday morning, and we're just going to go have a couple of Bloody Marys. I think we should stay and drink. They don't. So I got to leave with them. I don't understand having two drinks, but I'm going to go home. I'm going to work in the yard. I'm going to take a nap. I'm going to get up on Saturday night. I'm going to go out and drink the way I want to drink. I can at times. I'm trying to control it, and I'm trying to enjoy it. I can't do both. I did come to an understanding when Stephen was sharing about his cirrhosis of the liver, and I'm like, that never happened to me. See, I found out really early that if I got drunk and I ate, I'm going to throw up in the morning. It just doesn't mix. And if I worked all day and I ate and then I drank, I'm going to throw up in the morning. So I figured out that if I ate at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 12 o'clock noon was too early, because I'd start drinking at 4:30 or 5. If I ate at noon and I started drinking at 5, I was going to get too drunk, too fast, too out of control. If I ate at 4 and I started drinking at 5, I'm going to throw up. 2 o'clock was perfect. I still don't get hungry for lunch until 2 o'clock. Honest. It's just like I like this bottle in my hand. I have this muscle memory. I still feel really comfortable with a drink in my hand, even if just water. Makes my head settle down just a little bit. So, I always thought that my problem was how much I drank. I always thought that I didn't lose jobs. I had my own business. I built a really good career drinking. I had all this evidence. By the way, I have this, actually it's human. I like to think it's unique. I have this aspect, and it says that I'm only able to look at evidence that makes me right. So I spent years amassing evidence that I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't drink in the morning. I'm a bar drinker. I don't drink alone. Jennifer, she's definitely an alcoholic. I heard her. She said, you know, she would get a bottle and go home. To me, that's an alcoholic. I go to the bar. I'm there to socialize. I'm there to meet and greet. It just happens to be drinking. Now, the fact that I can go to the bar at 5 o'clock in the evening, close the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning, get in the car with a bunch of people, drive down to Tijuana, close that bar at 6 o'clock in the morning, go back to the bar at 6 o'clock in the morning, and drink all day until my 5 o'clock shift at that bar. That doesn't make me an alcoholic. I'm just partying. I didn't drink in the morning. I didn't lose my job. I didn't have a family. Didn't lose my family. Like I said, I left Utah. It took me until I was going back to Utah. My mom died right after I got sober. I got sober on the 9th of September. She died on the 15th of November. And I was in a recovery home. I was in the recovery home at that time. And I went to her funeral. And the next year for Christmas, I went to my little sister's for Christmas. And she had packed up my mom's stuff. And she had this manila envelope of stuff that she had got from my mom. And it was birthday cards and Christmas cards that my mom had tried to send me that had been returned to her because she didn't have the current address of where I was. And one of the things that was in there was this piece of paper. I unfolded this piece of paper, and it had a list of names, and then it had a dollar amount next to each name. And I'm going through these things, and I'm opening the cards, you know, 25 years later. I'm opening these cards for my mom. And I come to this piece of paper, and I decide that I start to throw it away, and I'm like, oh, when I was a missionary, when I was going to be a missionary, all these people gave me cash to help me buy my suit and to help me send me on my mission. And what happened, I didn't complete that two-year mission. I was out there for 10 months and said, I got to go. This doesn't work for me. I can't do what I want to do. And what I kept doing was stealing the mission car and driving to the airport and flying to New York and hanging around 42nd Street and the Port of Authority. And I was 18, and it was the late 60s, and you could drink in New York in the late 60s. And they had these great bars. You'd go into the restaurant, and they'd knock on the back door, and they'd open the door, and they'd give them the secret word, and you'd go back in the back room and drink. And I didn't know until I got sober that what I was doing was fulfilling that need to drink. You can have a craving. I can have a craving. I don't know about you guys. I can have a craving that's not satisfied for months. And unfortunately, in those months that I'm craving, I'm obsessed. I don't know I'm obsessed. I know I need to change the way I feel. And the only thing that I've ever found that works every time, it would work today. It would work tonight if I walked away from this meeting. If I walked away from this meeting. And for some reason, I thought what would work is a drink. I know a drink would work for me. A drink has always worked for me. It never stopped working. It's always altered my sense of reality. It's always altered my perception of what you think of me. I didn't know that's what was going on. If you're new tonight, one of the things I would like to convey to you is that everything that I'm talking about, everything that I'm sharing with you is something that I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous after the fact. When I was sitting there, 18 years old, dissatisfied on my mission, I didn't go, oh, you're restless, irritable, and discontent. You need a drink. Oh, no, you shouldn't drink. You know, when I was in the Navy, and I turned 21, and 3 days later, they transferred me up to the Bay Area, and I was stationed at Old Knoll Naval Hospital. So that was October 5th. I checked in at Oakdale Naval Hospital. So October, November, I get a pass to go over to San Francisco, and it's like, woohoo, I'm out on pass, and it's Thanksgiving, and I have actually 2 days before I have to be back to base. And I start drinking, and I start partying, and I start meeting people, and come on, there's a party over here. Come to our house for Thanksgiving dinner. And I forgot to go back to the Navy. Don't you know? It's like, I'm drinking. I'm meeting people. And so, if you've ever been in the military, what you know is you end up getting written up for being AWOL. You have to go in front of the captain. They call it a captain's mast because during the days of sailing ships, they would mete out punishment at the mast. So they call it a captain's mast. So in the Navy, if you go to three captain's masts, they're going to give you a verbal recommendation for discharge. On your fourth captain's mast, they're going to put a written recommendation in your personnel record to be discharged out of the Navy. On your fifth captain's mast, they discharge you out of the military with a bad conduct or dishonorable discharge. On my 13th captain's mast, they finally decided that we weren't getting along. I was discharged from the Navy for the benefit of the Navy, go figure, right? Because I have this hard time showing up for work. And the funny thing is that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys started talking about losing jobs, I would have told you I never lost a job. I never lost a job for drinking. I lost a career in the Navy. I did not lose a job. I gave that up. It's like, no, we did not get along. Once again, people telling me what to do. Stupid me. If all I had done was cut my hair, shine my brass, iron my uniform, I could have got away with murder. But see, I'm not even willing to do the little things. I'm just like, You can't tell me what to do. I was 22 years old. And I was free. I was on my own. I had to go find a job. There's a neighborhood bar down the street from the apartment that I had moved into. They said, hey, you're in here every day. How'd you like a job? I'm like, sure. I'm like, I don't know how to use a blender. They're like, that's okay. Our blender's broken. We don't do those drinks here. They said, here's what we'll do. You can work as a bartender, and you can keep your tips, and we won't give you any wages until you learn how to tend bar. I worked one shift. Because how hard is it to make a rum and coke or a scotch and water? And I learned real quick that if I didn't know how to make a drink, all I had to do was ask you, well, how do you like that? And you're going to tell me exactly how you want your drink made. That was, I love tending bar. I love tending bar. And I'm on this side of the bar. You're all over there. This is all mine. You're over there trying to find a seat. You're over there trying to get my attention, which I love. And I'm over here and I can walk. If I don't want to talk to you, I just walk away and go take care of somebody else. If I'm interested in you, I give you all the attention I want. And it's okay because I'm taking care of business. I love tending bar. I love being in bars. Unfortunately, I have a tendency to drink while I work. There was this great bar that I worked up in San Francisco in the early 70s. And I worked the night shift, and I would show up for work, and the very first thing I would do is I would light a joint, and I would turn around, and I would put my back to the bar, and I would sit there, and I would smoke my joint. And this guy was a great bar owner. He was very smart. I could give away all the tap beer I wanted. I could give away a six-pack of bottled beer, and I could give away three mixed drinks a night. He expected me to give you a free drink after you'd had a couple, because that's good business, as long as I didn't give you the first one. Because you might only be in there for one. Who goes into a bar for one drink? I got kind of lost here, guys. Sorry. It's a story I haven't told in a long time. Needless to say, I got mixed up with 70s. I was in San Francisco in my 20s in the 70s. Good times. Drinking was not a problem. Cocaine was a problem. The black beauties were a problem. I didn't do any speed while I was in San Francisco because everybody in the 70s knew that speed kills. And you can't trust speed freaks because they're going to rip you off. So I just did all this other stuff. Lots of LSD. Love LSD. Oh, loved it. Clear light just opened my mind, showed me what was really going along. I just loved it. I came to San Diego in 1978. I came here with 4,000 hits of acid. I had to finance my trip. I was leaving San Francisco because I had a problem with cocaine. And I came to San Diego. I got off the bus, 10:30 at night. My problem is cocaine, right? I get off the bus. I walk up there. Back then, in the late 70s in downtown San Diego, there was no Horton Plaza. There were theaters there. And I walked up to the ticket counter, and I said, where's the nearest bar? Because I just got off a bus from San Francisco. I needed a drink. It was 10:30 at night. They sent me down to 10th and Broadway, where all the my kind of bars are. There used to be some great bars down there in the 70s and 80s, 90s. And I found this bar, and it was the bar that I drank in for the next, how long did I drink? From 1978 till 2001? That was my bar. I was a bartender there. I was the doorman there. I walked in. They welcomed me. I let the bartender know that I had a few little acid tabs with me. I became an instant success. I bring up drugs for one reason. I had a lot of experience with drugs. My favorite way to do a drug is to dissolve it in water and put it in a syringe. Because I want the effect immediately. I tried heroin once. My roommate was shooting heroin with his girlfriend. I got all freaked out. He's like, you don't know what you're talking about. Let's do some heroin. So you know what you're talking about. The next day we went to a dog show. Morley Field. We didn't have a dog. So we go to this dog show at Morley Field. I'm feeling like crap. I'm feeling like death warmed over. I know that everybody at that dog show is looking at me, and they can tell that I just did heroin last night. I feel like crap. I'm like, okay, I understand why somebody might do heroin again if you feel this way. Because it does not feel good. I can't understand doing heroin again knowing that this is what's going to come next. I never did heroin again. I like shooting speed. I like shooting cocaine. I like shooting acid. 5 hits of acid, wham. It took me 2 years, 2 years of somebody offering me a hit of acid, wanting to say no. And I finally said, no, thank you. I don't want any acid. No problem. I shot speed for 5 years. 1985, I decided I needed to go to school and learn a profession. I said to myself, you know, I can't go to school and shoot speed. Ain't going to fly. I was about half a gram a day. I put the needle down. Never picked that needle back up again. I've never done speed since that day. That was 1985. I didn't get sober until 2001. Here's what happened when I put that needle down. I used to buy a pint of vodka every day. I'd take my girlfriend, I would take her son, and we would take the dog, and we would go for a walk every afternoon. And I would stop at the liquor store, and I would buy a pint of vodka. And as we walked the dog up, he lived over in Golden Hill, and we'd walk up Florida Street. I would buy a pint of vodka, and that's where I would drink. As soon as I stopped shooting the speed, I started buying a quart of vodka. Now, I was in trade school. It was cosmetology school. And I come out of a blackout, and I'm urinating over the dirty dishes in the sink. There's a lot of stories. I mean, you know, a lot of stories about coming to, urinating where I'm not supposed to be. And my girlfriend's like going, "You pig. You pig." And I'm like, "Me? Their dishes are dirty." Do the dishes. So she says, "I can't live this way. Your drinking is out of hand." She takes her 5-year-old son. They leave the house. And she says, "I'm going to stay in my car until you leave." Wow, that last 10 minutes went really fast. So, fast forward. There's a part of my story Larry likes. It's a good example of my selfish self-centeredness. So I'm working. Like I said, I like to go to the bars. Part of the evidence that I'm not an alcoholic is that I don't drink alone. So I always take people home from the bar when it's Saturday night, Friday night. So there's always somebody willing. There's always a party going on at my house on the weekend. So I bring a bunch of people home. We're drinking. We're doing party favors. I've got a client coming in at 9 o'clock the next morning. People start passing out. It's time for me to go to bed. I go to bed. I get up. There's somebody passed out on the sofa. I go over. I push on his chest. I'm like, "Come on, you got to go. I'm like, "I can't wait for this guy." I call this kid named Frankie. He's coming to clean my house. It's Saturday. I go to work. I get a phone call at 9:30. It's Frankie. He says, "Darwin, this guy's dead." I'm like, "Handle it. Click." I'm busy. I'm taking care of clients. I'm doing the important stuff right now. Click. Handle it. About half an hour later, I get a call from the police department. I told him, actually, I said, "Go downstairs and get Kathy's boyfriend to help you carry him to the bus stop." She comes up, finds out he's dead. She calls the police. Nosy neighbors. So I get a call from the police department. I tell them what happened. They find this card in his pocket. He'd just gotten out of prison. He'd gone down to Tijuana. I didn't know that he had taken a bunch of Valium, with a Valium and the vodka and the beer and everything. He OD'd. I didn't care. I mean, I'm at work. Don't you understand? I'm taking care of clients. And the funny thing is, the client that I had, fast forward about 18 months, 2 years, it's street scene. My salon's in the middle of street scene. I'm fenced off. My salon is like Party Central. You come down, you put your cases of beer, you bring your wine, you bring your weed, you bring whatever it is you want to party with. I give you a wristband so that you can come and use my bathroom, and we're partying. And in the morning, I'm taking care of clients. Well, I wake up on Friday morning out of this blackout. I'm like, "Oh," I pop up out of bed. I lift up the covers. The Chihuahua is there. Put the covers back down. Everything's okay. Except I have this vague memory of my landlord telling me that I've got to move my salon. I've got 60 days to move my business. I go back to work on Friday morning. Everybody says, "Chill. Kurt's just all freaked out. Everything's going to be okay. Just chill today." The next thing I know, I'm coming out of a blackout in the middle of another fight with my landlord. My solution, I went and made a gin and tonic because that's the only booze that was there. And I get up the next morning and I go to work, and there's a note on the door and it says, "Darwin, call Kurt. My key doesn't work." I'm like, "Holy shit. I've been locked out of my salon." And I'd promised myself earlier that if my drinking ever affected work, I would do something about it. I'm like, "Oh, no. I can't get in. He's not answering his phone. My 9 o'clock client shows up. I'm sitting on the curb crying because the gig is up." She goes, "What's the matter?" I said, "Do I think I have a problem with alcohol?" She goes, "I know." This woman had been my 9 o'clock appointment every 4 weeks for 6 years. This morning, my Thursday night, my home group had a workshop. I got up at 5:45. I showered. I had to dress like this because I was doing 10 minutes at that gig. And I can feel my phone ringing in my pocket. I talked to Sandy and Dawn, and I said, "Okay, I can't. I need to move your 9 o'clock to 1 o'clock. They forgot. They showed up at my house. So I finally get in contact with them. They show up at 1 o'clock, and Sandy goes, "If your neighbors start asking you what's going on, here's what happened. We showed up. You weren't here. We called the police. Because we didn't know what happened to you. We were afraid. I'm a little older than most of this room, so they were afraid that maybe I died of a heart attack. The dogs were there. The door was open. And in the conversation with Sandy and Don this morning, they never once thought I might be drunk. And if this had happened 13 years ago, the first thing Sandy would have thought is, oh, Darwin got drunk and didn't show up for work this morning. This morning, because of you guys, because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing that came into her mind is something's happened to Darwin. We need to see what they were calling the hospitals. It was like, I'm like, really? So from that thing I ended up in a treatment center. In that treatment center, 2 weeks into that treatment center, I'm like, I need to call my landlord because I'm going to be in here for 30 days. That means 30 days I need before I can move my salon. That's just, and I call Kurt. And what I find out from Kurt is that Saturday morning, he was locking up his doors at 5 o'clock in the morning when street scene was over. And he'd put his keys in the door and he'd went back to the back of the store to get something. And he came back and somebody had stolen his keys. He was up getting the store rekeyed. The note was to let me know that there was going to be no booze allowed in that salon, that store, after 5 o'clock. I couldn't even work after 5 o'clock. I did have to move my salon. What I didn't know about Kurt is that at 9 years old, he watched his father hemorrhage from acute alcoholism. He was afraid he was going to come into that salon and find me dead. The note on the door, him and his employee had got their phones mixed up. I'm calling Kurt. It's ringing over at Lee's house. Lee's not going to answer the phone because they've been up all night rekeying. And I got off the phone. I'm 2 weeks sober. I haven't had a drink in 2 weeks. The only solution that I could come up with is that God had intervened in my life. I was a man that didn't want a relationship with God, wasn't looking for a relationship with God, was convinced that God hated me because of what happened to me as a young Mormon boy. And here I had this evidence. The only thing that I could come up with is God had intervened in my life. I don't remember asking for help. You know, a lot of people will say they said their prayer. I probably woke up at that one, when I said I woke up at 1 o'clock and found the Chihuahua still there, I probably said, oh God. And God took that opportunity. I know that God intervened in my life. Without my permission and without me asking. I have a relationship with a higher power that I wasn't looking for and didn't want. Keeps me sober. Keeps me in the middle of this room. I have a sponsor in one hand. I have a sponsee in another hand. If you're doing that, when I'm doing that, I can't drink. Doing what Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to do. 2 minutes. This is what allows me to stay sober. About 5 years ago, when Peter died, Peter was just he was my first sponsor. He was a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to ask somebody else to be my sponsor. I wanted to go back to even before that. In 2007, I put this hand into a table saw, working on an apartment for another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ended up at the emergency room. And 10 minutes later, my sponsor and his wife and one of my sobriety brothers walked in. And everything was taken care of. And 6 months later, my house burned. I got sober so I could save all my stuff. 6 years of sobriety. While I was at La Mesa Men's, my house was gutted by fire. And I lost everything. 4 out of my 5 dogs died in that fire. The next morning, I was up buying underwear and shaving gear and toothpaste and toothbrush. Because I lost everything. Saturday night at my Saturday night meeting that I'm usually at, people showed up who didn't like me, and I didn't like, with bags of clothes for me. One of my sobriety brothers put me up in his home for 3 months until I could get stuff together so I could move into my own apartment, so I could set up a new salon, because my salon was behind my house. And you guys, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it has always been there. It comes in and it picks me up. The women from Alcoholics Anonymous came and did my laundry when my hand was bandaged from surgery. The men from Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm at a Sunday morning men's meeting every Sunday. They went to their Sunday morning men's meeting, and then they came to my house to bring me a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things when my house burned is I did not miss my Saturday night meeting, my Sunday morning meeting, my Monday night meeting, my Wednesday night meeting, my Thursday night meeting, my Friday night meeting. I kept going to my meetings. I kept my commitments. I kept my word to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you guys picked me up. You are the wind beneath my wings. I've been wanting to say that for a while. So, if you're new tonight, nearly new, new again, thinking about being new, want to be new, whatever. Because I know you're out there. Not only have I found a relationship with a power greater than myself that has allowed me to stay sober, I found a way of living that I always wanted. I found true love and true care for other people. I found true love and true care from other people to me. I've been in AA, by staying sober, what's happened to me is I've allowed you to love me. And for somebody like me, that's huge. Because up until I got sober and found you guys, it wasn't possible. So thank you for being here tonight.